Chapter 9. In a Positive Direction. The unlikely story of Pegasus Project Forensics begins on a small farm in the flatlands of Central Ireland, in the waning months of the 20th century, with a 5-year-old boy alone in his bedroom, playing for hours on end with his first computer. The farm itself was a modest dairy operation with 40 cows, nothing Danica O'Carroll's father couldn't handle by himself, as long as he was up every morning at dawn to do the milking, and willing to put in a solid 12 hours most days. But the 60-acre property was also home to legend and lore and purpose. It was known as the Ring, for the distinctive circular hedgerow, a few hundred meters in diameter, that surrounded the farm. Buried somewhere within that circle, it was believed, were the ruins of Loretto Castle, the ancient seat of one of the storied clans in Irish history. The O'Carrolls counted themselves descendants of Olil Olam, king of Munster in the 3rd century AD. The clan enjoyed a good long regal run, followed by 1,000 years of foreign invasion, foreign rule, and general woe, a millennium that sharpened the O'Carrolls into an instrument of fierce and stubborn resistance. They fought the Vikings, the Normans, and a variety of English overlords. The clan won plenty of battles, but few wars, and lived in the main under what they considered alien rule. The O'Carrolls, or the Carrolls when anglicized, suffered centuries of indignity and casualty, but would not concede defeat. When Oliver Cromwell confiscated their estates for the benefit of the English crown, Danica's forebears took their losses and stood their ground. When Cromwell's troops burned Loretto Castle down to its foundation, Danica's forebears stood their ground. When the inhumane policies of the English overlords turned a potato blight into a famine that killed the Irish or sent them fleeing to other lands by the millions, Danica's people stood their ground. Danica's own father had been a soldier in the last great resistance, back in the 1970s and 1980s, as a member of the Irish Republican Army, sworn to defend the minority Catholic population in the violent back and forth with the Protestant majority of Northern Ireland. These deadly conflagrations in Armagh and Londonderry and Belfast might have been the dying twitches of the 500-year fight between the English and the Irish, but they were deeply felt. Danica's father came of age in a boiling stew of what one trenchant observer called grim, lingering rage, a quiet, determined, smoldering spite, resentment. By the time he was 30, John Carroll had paid a dear price for his resistance. He spent a year on the run, moving from safe house to safe house, and then 5 years in prison on a weapons charge. John Carroll had been a part of dramatic prison hunger strikes, 47 days in his case, that made martyrs of the IRA members who didn't survive them. But that was all a long time ago, by the end of the 20th century, just 2 years before he bought his son the Gateway PC Windows 98 desktop computer. John Carroll had formally and demonstrably put his long-ago past behind him. He pleaded guilty in an Irish court, after 11 separate interrogations at the local police station, to past membership in the Irish Republican Army. He received a suspended sentence, noted the local newspaper, after signing a promise not to associate with any subversive organizations or individuals connected with subversive organizations. John Carroll had become a respected leader in his local community by then. Aside from running his dairy farm, Danica's father was a 15-year member of the Burr Town Council and headed for a seat on the Offaly County Council. The issues closest to his heart to this day are universal preschool and equity. He also champions humane treatment of the much maligned Irish travelers, regarded by most as a Gaelic version of the unwanted gypsies. He always sought to look after the marginalized in the county, one of his fellow board members says of him. An inclination to resist those who abuse their power and sympathy for the underdog. These were Danica's chief inheritances from his father, and from the long, unbroken line of O'Carrolls that preceded them both. Funny thing about Danica, though, the grim, lingering rage, the smoldering spite, the resentments that attended so much of his family history are not the animating force in his own life. Like those mythic castle ruins buried somewhere in the ring, they might be there, and they might not. It'd take some careful digging to find out. What animates Danica, without question, is curiosity. Curiosity has been the fount of almost all of his triumphs, and almost all of his considerable tribulations. Curiosity was what kept that little boy up later than he should have been on school nights, tapping away at a keyboard with the glow of a computer monitor lighting his otherwise dark room. Rural Ireland at the turn of the late 1990s didn't offer much in the way of internet connectivity. This was the dial-up era, with interminable wait times and a pretty thin menu of gruel to fetch once you finally entered the World Wide Web. Much more interesting than the public-facing websites themselves, Danica found, was what was happening in the background, where he found a whole new, just-being-written computer language to master. He even convinced his parents to drive him to computer certification courses. "I was 7," he says. "I remember there were a bunch of adults in their 40s and 50s on the computer, and I was this 7-year-old kid who was kind of seeing everything." His parents didn't really understand what he was up to, but they gave him the time and space he needed to pursue his uncommon interests. They didn't push him out to play with his friends or make heavy demands on his time with chores around the farm. In fact, by the time Danica was 10 or 11, his father had sold the milk cows. It was clear to him he was unlikely to have a next-generation partner in his agricultural endeavor. "The reason I'm good is that I could do this even before I was a teenager, before there are a lot more demands on your time. I had a lot of free time, and I was interested in computers," Danica says. "I saw people make mistakes on their websites, and how you can take the code and gain knowledge and gain information. It was a puzzle, a challenge." His parents did get a payoff of sorts when Danica was in high school. He medaled in computer programming at the Irish Science Olympiads 2 years in a row, and represented Ireland in the international contests that followed. By then, 2011, Danica had fallen in with a lot of other computer geeks who shared his general curiosity and his particular interest in the vast and always expanding digital puzzle. He made a whole set of interesting new friends out in the ether, and was enthralled to the growing community of hackers. This was the first golden age of the hacker, and the best had a nose for recognizing the best. Danica was invited into a shape-shifting platoon of hacker collectivists known as Anonymous, or LulzSec. Translation, laugh out loud security. LulzSec had about as much shared culture and community as the geek world offers. Hackers tend to think of themselves first and foremost as lone wolves, sui generis, with their own distinct specialties, their own chosen targets, their own motivations. For Danica, this was just a little good, clean fun. He could participate in online sit-ins and protests, or launch spitballs at the high and mighty, all from the safety of his own home, inside the ring. There was something unreal about it, and a sense that nobody was really watching. His teenage hacktivism wasn't serious, but it was undoubtedly political. He was a merry prankster who found it amusing to mess with people who lorded over others. His chosen username alias, a hacker must, was Palladium, which is both a chemical element, atomic number 46, often used as catalyst. Danica had just been accepted into the medicinal chemistry program at Trinity College Dublin, and a religious icon, or relic, with protective powers. The name also had a hint of the underdog. Saint Palladius was the first bishop of Ireland, who actually beat Saint Patrick to the Emerald Isle, but never got the credit, or the parades. Danica's first real hack was a prank on Fine Gael, the mushy, center-right Irish political party that had ballyhooed its intent to take campaigning into the digital age for the election of 2011. The party hired a hotshot American consultant who had embellished his role in the digital campaign revolution that helped elect Barack Obama president. Danica and a friend shut down the political technician's sparkly new Fine Gael site for a full 24 hours in the run-up to the election, and showed out the American campaign guru for the huckster he was. Danica's next prank was a good bit more fulfilling, but it also turned out to be a whole lot more perilous. Like the rest of the British Isles and much of the rest of the sentient English-speaking world, Danica had been following the public inquiry into the latest happenings in press baron Rupert Murdoch's malodorous media abattoir. Reporters from Murdoch's News of the World tabloid had stolen voicemails from the phones of thousands of private individuals. The contents of many of these messages were then leaked for clicks and eyeballs. Among the alleged victims were former Prime Ministers Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, Spice Girl Victoria Beckham, Eric Clapton, Prince Charles, and most monstrously, a 13-year-old schoolgirl who had been abducted and murdered. The ugly scandal drew only minor corporate comeuppance. News of the World was shuttered, and a few of Murdoch's lower-level employees eventually ended up in prison. But it seemed clear that Murdoch was going to walk away, as he always did, without suffering any real consequences. So a few members of Lowell's sect decided to take matters in hand. On July 18, 2011, a few months after his high school graduation, Danica and friends hacked the website of Murdoch's flagship London newspaper, The Sun, and redirected all traffic to a fake homepage they had created. "I thought it would be fine," Danica says. "The Sun was racist, anti-immigrant. I told my friends that we could do a joke and nobody would really care." It was a pretty good joke. Bannered across the fake Sun homepage was the news of Rupert Murdoch's apparent suicide. The story itself was an obvious lampoon with little attempt at subtlety. Murdoch, age 80, was said to have ingested a large quantity of palladium before stumbling into his famous topiary garden late last night, passing out in the early hours of the morning. One detective elaborates. Officers on the scene report a broken glass, a box of vintage wine, and what seems to be a family album strewn across the floor, containing images of days gone by, some containing hand-painted portraits of Murdoch in his early days, donning a top hat and monocles. Another officer reveals that Murdoch was found slumped over a particularly large garden hedge fashioned into a galloping horse. His favorite, a butler, Davidson, reports. Rupert Murdoch was not amused. 7 weeks later, at 7 o'clock on a late summer morning, 16 Irish law enforcement officers stormed the O'Carroll household, dragged Danica out of bed, handcuffed him, and demanded that he confess to various cybercrimes. The police kept Danica's parents cordoned off in another room of the house. His mother was confused and understandably terrified, but his father did manage to get his head out the door long enough to shout some advice to his son. "Whatever you do, say nothing," he said. "Don't say anything to the police." The investigators on scene gathered up all the computers they could find and hauled Danica into the local police station. He must have seemed a very unlikely suspect in that precinct, a skinny teen with a slightly rounded and whiskerless face, quick to smile and easy to like. The cops pressed their interrogation nonetheless and tried to rattle him by explaining that the American election guru hired by Fine Gael had gotten the FBI involved, and the FBI was busy gathering a lot of digital evidence concerning palladium. Danica took his father's advice and kept his mouth shut. The police were forced to release him after 24 hours, the longest they could hold him without a charge, which they were ill-prepared to make. But the story of his arrest was all over the newspapers, and the police made sure the 18-year-old computer whiz, who was headed off to university in a few weeks, understood this wasn't over. That got real, Danica remembers of his first arrest. Oh, people do care what goes on in a computer. That was kind of eye-opening. And yet, he stood his ground, maybe even fought back a little. By the time Danica completed his first year at Trinity College Dublin, in the spring of 2012, he was notorious. It looked like he was headed for trial in the Fine Gael prank. He had been identified by the FBI, but not yet charged in the Murdoch prank. And most spectacularly, he was under suspicion of hacking the police themselves. A criminal complaint filed by the FBI in the Southern District of New York asserted that after his initial arrest in September 2011, Danica O'Carroll, the FBI special agent who authored the complaint, misspelled his name, had infiltrated the digital world of the several police forces who had him under investigation. Just got into the iCloud for the head of a national cybercrime unit. Danica had allegedly written to an unnamed FBI informant. I have all his contacts and can track his location 24/7. The FBI claimed in its legal filing that Danica had then accessed the Gmail accounts of the cybercrime commander and one of his detectives, and stolen the password needed to access a conference call scheduled for the FBI, the Irish Constabulary, and the Serious Organized Crime Agency in London. The criminal complaint further alleged that Danica not only dialed into and listened in on the conversation, which touched very briefly on developments in his own case, but actually recorded the call in its entirety, posted it on a public site, and invited listeners. The discussion on the recording suggested a certain fecklessness among the investigators. The crack cyber investigators in Ireland apparently neglected to dial in at all. The case against Danica went nowhere, even after the Irish police held him for questioning for 30 hours, because the FBI didn't have enough evidence. But the criminal complaint in a U.S. federal court and the accompanying press release issued by the FBI did put Danica in the news again. The publicity made him a sudden new hero in the hacker community, a community dedicated to watching the watchers. But it only increased the fire he was drawing from the very powerful people he had very publicly embarrassed, like Rupert Murdoch and law enforcement agents from London to Dublin to New York. His father stuck by his side the whole way. But the legal jeopardy dogged Danica throughout his university career and beyond. He was eventually ordered by an Irish court to pay 5,000 euro in damages to Fine Gael. Meanwhile, lawmen fed stories to the newspapers about the chemistry lab the chemistry major had used for experiments in his parents' home. Couldn't that be used for making ecstasy or bombs? They also revealed information about the items on Danica's bedroom wall and his Facebook page. He posted quotes from the Marxist revolutionary Che Guevara and IRA martyr Bobby Sands. He was an avowed socialist. By March 2017, when Danica O'Carroll was finally brought to court, where he admitted his role in the Murdoch hack in exchange for a 9-month suspended sentence, he had learned a valuable lesson about the pursuit of justice. Whoever has the ability to write the code has the ability to control the system. I wouldn't recommend it, Danica says of his 6-year ordeal. But it was definitely an interesting life experience to see how the world works and how states operate, and how powerful people get pissed off by these things that are just pranks and have a lot of resources to try and do something about it. And it was also interesting to see how the criminal justice system works. You're in court and you see all of these people, a whole industry, supported by people being charged with mundane stuff, hacking or other kinds of crime, lawyers and judges and police and everyone involved in a kind of assembly line of justice. It's a whole industry. Seeing how all that works was fascinating. Fortunately, it worked out without me going to prison. But this was kind of an unsustainable way of doing activism. I was trying to figure out, how do I use some of these skills in a positive direction? A self-taught computer scientist, but a formally trained university-educated chemist, Danica had been torn between pursuing a career in computers or a career in chemistry. Each of the disciplines played to his preternatural curiosity, which manifested in a desire to find out how things work, right down to the root. The method in both his chosen fields of research is to break down the operating systems into their smallest component parts, their code, and then recombine those parts for novel, hopefully better purposes. I like trying to get computers to do things not intended, and putting things together in a way that's creating something new, he says. And what is chemistry? It's understanding what nature designed. It's kind of like hacking the molecules of chemistry to make something new. The life of a chemist in a laboratory had one distinct advantage: fewer police raids and interrogations and indictments. But all roads seemed to lead back to computers. When he arrived in Berlin as a 21-year-old college student to begin a 3-month chemistry research project, Danica found himself in a promised land of hackers and computer security geeks, complete with its own Moses. In the year since goateed ex-National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden catapulted to fame, he has been portrayed in street art, installations, pop songs, and performances, the Wall Street Journal reported/lamented, not to mention stickers, posters, and fridge magnets. In Germany, in particular, revelations of the NSA's eavesdropping activities have tapped into the deep-seated aversion to an omniscient, all-powerful state, giving birth to a Snowden cult among creative types here. 2 weeks in Berlin, and Danica knew 30 different cyber geeks locked in a battle against the rising tide of cyber surveillance. Danica ended up back in Berlin after graduation in the summer of 2015, a few weeks after the unveiling in Alexanderplatz of the life-size bronze statues of Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, and Chelsea Manning, the U.S. whistleblower who had released hundreds of thousands of documents to WikiLeaks, a number of them classified or sensitive, and a lot more of them simply embarrassing. Danica was in Berlin for a summer of privacy internship at Tor, a nonprofit cybersecurity venture. "We believe everyone should be able to explore the internet with privacy," read the Tor mission statement. "We advance human rights and defend your privacy online through free software and open networks." He liked the work and the sense of purpose, and decided to make Berlin home. His first full-time job was with an NGO that created digital tools to help journalists, human rights defenders, and under-resourced civil society organizations to fight back against cyber attacks and state-run censorship. Among the Berlin cyber luminaries Danica got to know was the white hat hacker running the cybersecurity department at Amnesty International. Actually, Claudio Guarnieri was the cybersecurity department at Amnesty, playing a lonely game of whack-a-mole to provide some small measure of protection for human rights defenders, political dissidents, and journalists who were increasingly under cyber threat from repressive and murderous governments around the world. In early 2018, Claudia told Danica that Amnesty Tech had freed up the money to hire a second threat researcher. "I thought about it for a bit," Danica says, "and then I was like, okay, this was exactly fitting my skills." Part of the appeal of the job at Amnesty Tech was the chance to work closely with Claudio. Danica had first started reading his new boss's blog posts and technical papers back in 2012 and 2013, when he was still a chemistry student at Trinity College Dublin. Claudio not only had the brain power, but, according to a story that appeared in a glossy popular American magazine, he also had the stamina required to track the private vendors of cyber surveillance across the vast landscape of the World Wide Web. Claudio had once used a single digital clue to help link Gamma Group and its Finn Fisher spyware to some unsavory customers. He saw that when he pinged the IP address of a collection server, it replied with an unusual response. "Hello, Steffi," Vanity Fair's Brian Burrow explained in a 6,500-word article about a posse of computer geeks on the hunt for cyber weapons. Guarnieri then used a program to survey every server on the internet, roughly 75 million of them, to see if others responded the same. It took a couple of long weeks, but in the end, the scan turned up 11 IP addresses in 10 countries, including Qatar, Ethiopia, and the UAE, that were known to monitor dissidents. Claudio was a rare bird in a community whose members took pride in being outside politics. Even before he was 30, he had developed a distinct worldview that defined his work. He would sometimes sum it up with a quote by an early computer technologist and founding executive editor of Wired, Kevin Kelly. "There is no powerfully constructive technology that is not also powerfully destructive in another direction. Just as there is no great idea that cannot be greatly perverted for great harm. The greater the promise of a new technology, the greater its potential for harm as well." For Claudio, this was just stating the obvious. "Everything we built over the decades and we consider a technology of liberation and self-determination," he told a conference of hackers in 2016, "we discovered had been turned into a tool for repression as well. And it was inevitable." He had come by this personal philosophy honestly because he had witnessed the phenomenon firsthand. Drawn to computer tech, like Danica, by the challenge of deciphering code, of puzzling out how the cyber world works and why, Claudio's political awakening came in his close observation of the Arab Spring and its aftermath. The initial success of the political uprisings in places like Egypt and Morocco and Bahrain was fueled by social media and instant electronic communication. The same technology had also been used to roll back the gains. Those cyber surveillance weapons that French companies had developed and then sold to state actors in Egypt and Libya, for instance, helped to vaporize dissent. A lot of people fighting for freedom and democracy in the Arab world ended up in exile or in prison or dead. Claudio was profoundly changed by watching it happen. One of his office mates liked to tell people about Claudio's singular work routine back in those days. She would see him surfing through the Twitterverse, growing angrier and angrier, until he finally hit his trigger point. Then he would turn to the drum set next to his workstation, pick up his sticks, and flail away at a raucous death metal solo. 45 minutes later, and finally cooled off, he would put down his drumsticks and get back to business. There is a technological imbalance between states and their citizens, Claudio would remind his fellow hackers. Billions of dollars are poured into systems of surveillance, both passive and active, and not just by the United States, but really by any government that is wealthy enough to do so. Credible defenses really lag behind or remain inaccessible. and generally are only available to corporations and businesses with deep enough pockets. The few ambitious public projects attempting to change things radically are often faced with rather unsustainable funding models, which rarely will last long enough to grow these projects to maturity. And nation-states are very aware of this technological imbalance and use it to their own advantage. Claudio could tend toward fatalism, even when he was making an impassioned public plea. His otherwise sharp features would sometimes sag into a hangdog look. People who knew him best could sense the energy it required of him to battle that fatalism every single day. But he stayed in the fight. While other accomplished hackers signed on as highly compensated cybersecurity specialists, protecting the interests of the major corporations who wrote the checks, Claudio Guarnieri made it his mission to democratize cybersecurity and spread it far and wide. "Security can no longer be a privilege in the hands of those few who can afford it," he would say. "Security has to become a right. It has to be exercised and protected. It is the precondition for privacy, which is the key enabler for freedom of expression, which is a requirement for a healthy democracy." In 2014, he developed and released a tool to help political dissidents and journalists and human rights defenders identify spyware infections on their personal devices. His idea was to give people the tools to empower themselves to do the detection. The tool itself was hacky, in the pejorative sense, according to Claudio. Not quite fully baked, and not the success he had hoped for. "I wasn't really the best engineer back then," he admits. Claudio went back to the drawing board, technically and politically, recognizing that he needed a lot more skilled researchers and coders and engineers on his team. As he was signing on as senior and only technologist at Amnesty International, he also co-founded a hackers collective called Security Without Borders, and made a call for his fellow geeks to volunteer their spare time to correcting the imbalance in the state versus citizen cybersecurity battles. "We need to recognize the privilege we have as educated individuals and technicians," he said in announcing the new collective. "Dedicating your time and your abilities to the benefit of society is concretely a political choice, and you should embrace that with consciousness and pride." Security Without Borders did not really catch fire. And by the time Danica went to work at Amnesty Tech a year later, Claudio seemed to be edging near burnout. The cyber surveillance developers were turning record profits in 2018, while spreading their intrusive weapons all over the world. The never-ending battle against an enemy that was well-funded and well-protected by rich and powerful countries was a grind. The whack-a-mole game was growing old and unsatisfying. "He had been doing this work a lot longer than I had," Danica says. "And he was a bit cynical that we could have an impact with stuff and really kind of change the narrative." "Basically," Claudio said, "you can work on whatever." It was good to have that flexibility, but at the same time it was like, what are we going to do? The answer to that question kind of fell into their laps a few months into Danica's tenure. An Amnesty International staffer from Saudi Arabia contacted them about a WhatsApp message she had just received from somebody she didn't recognize. It was an urgent alert about a protest that was about to take place in front of the Saudi embassy in Washington. "We need your support, please," it read, and asked her to click on a link for more information. The AI staffer had already been warned about new cyber surveillance weapons aimed at cell phones, and she was worried somebody was trying this kind of attack on her. Claudio and Danica agreed she had reason to be worried, and they investigated. Looking inside the message and the link, they were able to isolate a signature quirk in the way the domain and server were configured. This WhatsApp message and link were painstakingly engineered to hide any information about the attack and any information about the identity of the attacker. The link and the final server were configured in a particularly locked-down manner. Any attempt to open a non-existent page on the server did not return the typical not found message. The server simply did not reply to the request at all, so as not to alert the victim. This already suggested to Claudio and Danica that they were not dealing with a common spam or cybercrime attack. But there was more to it still. The encryption algorithm on the server had been carefully tuned for added security. Paradoxically, all this extra care taken by the operators helped Claudio and Danica isolate and identify these servers, because they stood out as unique, different from any other servers on the internet. Once Claudio and Danica mapped that configuration, they possessed a kind of digital fingerprint. They then ran an internet scan in the summer of 2018, literally connecting to every single server on the web, looking for others that had the same configuration, the same digital fingerprint. They found almost 600 discrete matching servers acting as launch pads for related spyware attacks. The chances of discovering the provenance of these servers and the domain names they held would have been slim, but for some earlier forensic investigations run by the University of Toronto's Citizen Lab. Researchers at Citizen Lab had been dogging one particular cyber surveillance provider for a few years. In 2016, they not only found evidence that its spyware had successfully infected the cell phone of a human rights defender in the United Arab Emirates, they had been able to piece together the company's entire network infrastructure. Among other things, they had discovered hundreds of domain names linked to the company's servers. Citizen Lab published many of them for everybody to see. The company had reacted in a trice, rebuilding the entire system that made up its anonymizing transmission network and changing the domain names. But the company made a crucial error. It had reused two domain names from its earlier version, pine-sales.com and ecommerce-ads.org. That's how Claudio and Danica caught them out. They found those domain names in the new infrastructure, and that told them who was running the system. This was NSO Group. This was Pegasus. Each Pegasus installation server, or Command and Control, CNC server, hosted a web server on port 443 with a unique domain and TLS certificate, they would write. These edge servers would then proxy connections through a chain of servers referred to by NSO Group as the Pegasus Anonymizing Transmission Network. The search for new Pegasus domains matching the fingerprint also led Claudio and Danica to a second victim. Yahya Asiri was a former officer in the Royal Saudi Air Force, who had made himself an unwelcome thorn in the side of the Saudi royal family. Asiri had fled his home country under threat of physical harm, but still managed to operate a network of human rights activists in Saudi Arabia, and continued his pointed criticism of the ruling monarchy. He publicly questioned the Saudi royal family's religiosity, its governance, its maltreatment of its impoverished subjects, and its penchant for meting out barbaric punishments such as stoning, flogging, amputation, and beheading. In other words, Asiri said the sorts of things that invited these punishments for himself. It is an absolute monarchy which does not allow its citizens to participate in the way their own country is run, Asiri told one Western publication. They use Islam as an excuse to exploit their own people. This is in contradiction to fundamental Islamic teachings. He called on the royal family to write a national constitution that stood up for democratic institutions and ensured a just and fair and less lethal rule of law. Or he wanted them to cede power. The royal family reacted by making it plain they wanted Yahya Asiri's scalp. When Claudio and Danica checked Asiri's cell phone, they found an SMS message from May 2018 with a link that invited him into the malicious infrastructure built by NSO. This discovery gave the pair two separate pieces of evidence that suggested somebody in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia was operating NSO's Pegasus system. And they made this find several months before the assassination of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Amnesty International published the findings, and later a list of all the domain names linked to NSO attacks. Dana Ingleton scorched the company. Amnesty International will not stand idly by as companies such as NSO Group profit from selling their invasive Pegasus software to repressive states around the world. Citizen Lab backed Claudio and Danica with its own findings, and it all had very little impact. NSO company engineers did have to spend the time and money to rebuild all that infrastructure again, which included retiring another 600 domain names. Goodbye to All Day Cooking and Bargain-Service and BR-Travels and Buy Present For Me and CentrAsia-News and Classic-Furnitures and Easy Bet and Fresh Salad Today and Islam-Today and Map Update Zone and Movie-Tickets and Novosti 24/7 and Pine-Sales and Rock Music For You and Turismo-Aki and Waffles with Nutella. Hello to hundreds of new, banal-looking domain names capable of launching one of the most potent cyber weapons on the market. NSO, meanwhile, did not even bother to contest any specifics in the Amnesty Tech report. The company simply released a mealy statement about how their technology is licensed to government agencies only, and only to help them thwart terrorists and criminals. Any misuse, NSO claimed, was counter to the values we stand for. The Israeli Ministry of Defense dismissed Amnesty International's demand that it revoke NSO's export license because of the blatant abuse of AI staffers. The case for revocation, made in a lawsuit filed by Amnesty and others, was rejected in a court in Tel Aviv. When the court found for NSO, an unnamed company spokesperson used the victory to preen. The regulatory framework in which we operate is of the highest international standard. And to scold. Our detractors, who have made baseless accusations to fit their own agendas, have no answer to the security challenges of the 21st century. But the experience did have real and serious effects inside the Berlin office of Amnesty Tech, newly christened the Security Lab. Claudio and Danica had learned one very valuable lesson in their first joint research project. The Pegasus system was not invisible, and NSO's technologists were not invincible. They made mistakes. One consequential misstep NSO Group had made was in riling Claudio Guarnieri and his new partner, Danica O'Carroll. "I guess I got quite pissed off about the attack on the Amnesty staff member," Danica says, looking back on that moment. "I was annoyed and offended that NSO would sell Pegasus to somebody who would go after one of our own staff members. So I guess I had a bit of a grudge."